All right, enough senators having appeared to create a committee meeting. We are going to start this morning, and we're going to spend just a few minutes on the Early Learning Foundation, and that's just to hear from the business community. If you remember the last time we discussed MELF and early childhood, it was to talk about some of the language in MELF, and one of the things that we did is added some language that would subject them to some of the open meeting laws, etc. So I just wanted to hear briefly from them this morning and get their response to that. We haven't passed any of that language. We've just had a lot of proposals running back and forth between the House and the Senate on that. Then the next issue we're taking up is after the last hearing, we talked about the statewide school employee health insurance plan, and we had presentations from the analyst who worked on that and kind of the pro side. And after that meeting, I bet a half a dozen people approached me and said, when are we going to get a chance to speak? So this morning, some of the folks who are opposed to this will get their opportunity to speak. And so we'll be hearing from them. And if there's time, we will then go to the school choice initiatives, which there have been some questions about. And that was one of the options that the governor put into his proposal, was that there would be some school choice initiative of some kind passed in by the end of this session. So we will start with Mr. Byron Layer. I was just informed of how to pronounce his name. I've never pronounced it correctly. It's Layer, as in layer cake. So,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification on the agenda today. When we talk about school choice initiatives, are we also talking about charter school legislation today, or is it more in the bigger
I think, Representative, it would be some of the bigger things, such as the bill that you had in the House and all those other bills that we had with tax credits,
scholarships, programs, access grants.
Right, okay. All that kind of thing.
Thank you for the clarification.
And if we don't get through it this time, we will try to do it for the next. It'll just be postponed on the agenda. All right, Mr. Layer.
Madam Chair,
thank you.
Members of the committee, my name is Byron Layer. I'm an employee of Greater Twin Cities United Way, and I'm here representing the three original funding partners of the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation. Now, that would be United Way, the McKnight Foundation, and Cargill Incorporated. We know that there's been some discussion about the new language and the governance of the Early Learning Foundation, which we expect would be the organization that the commissioner would contract with under the terms of the language that you have in front of you.
Pull your mic up. So.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Is it on?
Thank you.
Should be. You can hear me?
Okay.
Yes,
thank
the
you.
System's on.
Anyway, our recommendation would be that you folks go with the original language that was in both bills, rather than having a public charity subject to the open meeting law and the other new language that's on page 2 of this bill. We think that the contracting requirement that the commissioner would have, as well as reporting requirements back to this body, which we would love to do, would be sufficient for accountability purposes. And having something new like open meeting laws apply to charitable organizations, it's just something new and different, and we would prefer to go back with the original language. And with that, I would stand for questions.
By the way, members, you all have in front of you the language that we discussed the last time, and then all the changes that we discussed, and then this is a proposal into which it is incorporated. And I thought we aren't passing on any of this today, but I thought we should at least hear from the people who would be most affected by it to see where they were at with it. Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, Mr. Lair, the I understand the concern about a typical nonprofit and not establishing a precedent of having it be subject to rules designed for state agencies. But this is something of a hybrid And my concern is that that we not give potential opponents a procedural reason for opposing state support for MELF by creating the impression that MELF is inadequately accountable. And I understand your points about the ways in which MELF would be accountable to the public, but the open meeting law, for example, since we're talking about a organization which is going to act as a conduit for public dollars along with private dollars, I'd be curious to know the specific rationale for concern about that or for the requirement for an audit or things like that.
Madam Chair and Senator.
Mr. Lehrer.
In terms of accountability, the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation will be a public charity and subject to the financial disclosure rules that the IRS has for all public charities, which means that their financials are not only available to the public, but we have to make them available in hard copy as well as on the internet. So in terms of transparency, simply the fact that the organization is going to be a 501c3 will provide that kind of transparency. In terms of your concern, we obviously wouldn't want to put you folks in a difficult position either in terms of dealing with potential opponents of this. Our feeling is that, and personally, I've worked for state government and county government, so I've been subject to the open meeting law. And I know that sometimes it can be difficult in terms of getting a board together and then posting notices and having that three-day wait. And those are the kinds of things that we just didn't think were necessary for this type of an organization. The commissioner, in fact, all commissioners who contract with nonprofits have financial reporting requirements that are built into those contracts. We just think those are sufficient. We also would be happy to have some kind of a requirement that would require us to come back here and report to this body. In fact, we'd prefer it. We think once we've got this thing underway and we're learning what the foundation is set up to do, that we would love the opportunity to come back here. And instead of having to ask you for a meeting, we could tell you it's required.
In other words, we'd have to give you committee time?
Sounds like it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Lehrer. The open meeting law is not necessarily preclude that meetings would be open. If somebody were interested that was not a member of your board but interested in sitting in on a meeting, do you envision that that's something that would be allowed?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Lehrer,
and Senator, we actually haven't talked about that. I've, in my experience with United Way in the past, we've been comfortable with folks coming into meetings. I was thinking more in terms of posting notices, not having a meeting without if I remember correctly, it's a three-day notice that has to be given to have a meeting. And those are things that typically would not be required in other kinds of contracts with the commissioner.
I'd just like to ask Mr. Strom or Ms. Larson or even one of the Senate staff, is there any organization that state gives money to, any charity organization that we don't have requirements for or whatever?
Madam Chair, members, the language in the amendment that you're looking at is exactly the same as the language that appears in 124D.385 on the Minnesota Commission on National Community Service. In Subdivision 4, it talks about a delegation to a nonprofit, and it says that if the Minnesota Commission creates a private nonprofit corporation, the corporation is not subject to laws governing state agencies or political subdivisions, except the provisions of Chapter 13, the open meeting law under Chapter 13, salary limits, and audits by the legislative auditor.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, I think there are a number of nonprofits which do get state dollars, but because there's a somewhat greater separation, they engage in many of them, you know, submit RFPs in order to get grants and so forth, so there's much less of a connection. We don't impose open meeting law requirements on those, but, you know, for example, the board of this organization is going to consist of members from the public sector and including state and local government officials. And so there's a much higher connection to the state. I don't want to push it because of my concern about whether this group will act responsibly with respect to state dollars, having been the author of the National Community Service Bill, creating Serve Minnesota Corporation. I just remember the debate on the Senate floor regarding subjecting them. The amendment that added this language. So I'm just trying to think ahead of future concerns that might be expressed about the creation of MELF.
Madam Chair.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I think as was clearly pointed out by Ms. Larson, the desire to have this section removed would be a new precedent, as we have legislation on a new commission in law, the Commission on National and Community Service. These components are part of that statutory language. So what Mr. Lair is asking us to do is to create new precedent when it comes to statutorily creating a commission. The question I have for Mr. Lair is, talked about your opposition to the audit in a very high level. We just don't think it's necessary. I'm not sure that's a standard I'm comfortable with in creating legislation when it comes to public dollars. If public dollars are being expended at a rate of 2-to-1, as I look at this, or 1-to-1 anyway, public to private, as I look at this legislation, I still don't understand what the objection is to an audit of the books. So if you could, is it a money thing? Is it too expensive? The level we don't want it or don't think it's necessary, I don't think meets my threshold of my fiduciary responsibility to taxpayers.
Madam Chair and Representative, perhaps I wasn't clear. This organization would be required to do an audit whether it was in this language or not. I understand the language here references the Legislative Auditor's Office. And first off, the charitable organization would be required to do an independent audit, and that audit would be a public record. In addition, I would assume that because money would be coming from this body or from the state, that the Legislative Auditor's Office would have a right to look at the books. So perhaps I misspoke, but I don't think we're talking differently here.
So, Madam Chair?
Representative Biskins.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Leary, if the Legislative Auditor does your audit, then you have fulfilled the requirement of having your books audited. So I don't know why it need not be redundant, and it sounds like to me that's your concern, is that you'd have two sets of audits done, but I don't know why that would necessarily have to be. If statutory language says it's the Legislative Auditor who does your audit, then your audit is done. And you said you have to have an audit done anyway. So I guess I'm a little confused as to why that language is a problem, particularly when what Senator Kelly said. That's a prime hook that opponents of this legislation are going to hang their hat on. All right, and it's curious to me that there might be something else going on here that I'm not quite sure of.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think what's going on is I'm not making myself really clear. We don't have a problem with the audit language. My primary concern was with the open meeting law. There will be at least one audit and one federal form 990 for this organization every year. And whatever else is required, either through state contracting or whatever authority the Legislative Auditor's Office might have to request additional financial information from this body.
Madam Chair?
Representative Biscuits.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and forgive me, and I appreciate your indulgence. And I want to go to the other two components of that sentence, all right? So there is no problem with the legislative auditor. So we can say if this does go forward, we're going to go ahead and put that in statutory language. What about the salary limits? You haven't touched on that much, so that might is that an okay component also that we should go ahead and leave in language?
Actually, whose salaries are we limiting here?
As I, Madam Chair, and my understanding in reading this was that any employee of the organization would be limited to, and I think this language says the governor's salary.
Probably.
So whatever the governor's salary is. Personally, I'd like to be limited to the governor's salary, so that's not a concern of mine. Again, my primary concern, and when the funders got together to actually draft the articles of incorporation to put this organization officially in business, the primary concern was the open meeting law. And but again, and maybe I was just trying to be too simplistic when we said we preferred the original language.
Representative Biscuit.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Then one final question that I have. Could the United Way, the McKnight Foundation, and the Minnesota School Readiness Business Advisory Committee come together to create a new 501c3 entity without statutory approval? Could this be done without...
Madam Chair and Representative, if you were to substitute the Cargill Corporation for the School Readiness Advisory Committee, we have already done that. The Articles of Incorporation were drafted at the end of last week, and our intention is that they would be filed with the Secretary of State possibly tomorrow.
All right.
And again, we don't need statutory language to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Mr. Lehrer, could you or these organizations not do this totally on their own without even any kind of government or bureaucratic intrusion, i.e. the seed money and avoidance of the open meeting law? Couldn't you just go ahead and do this on your own, even beyond what Representative Biscuits has referenced?
Mr. Lehrer.
Madam Chair and Representative, the Early Learning Foundation can be incorporated by those three entities, or actually any one individual, as long as they had three board members, and begin operating. The three organizations have jointly pledged $2.5 million to set up this organization, and that money will be there regardless of the legislation that may come out of this body. Obviously, we're hopeful for a partnership with the state on this, but the three organizations have pledged the money, and we can do that on our own.
Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, Mr. Lehrer, could you give us a sense of the intensity of the concern? I certainly understand not wanting to get caught with an inadvertent transgression on the open meeting law, failing to get the notice out within 3 days or something like that, but those are all doable, and I'm having trouble picturing a situation where the MELF board would have to meet on an emergency basis. That it strikes me that given the kinds of work the MELF board would be doing, it would meet every couple months or something like that, and wouldn't have much trouble with the notice provisions in most ordinary circumstances.
Madam Chair and Senator, I think you're right. In most circumstances, posting notices or sending out notices to individual board members or members of the public that have indicated an interest would not be a problem. But there are those extraordinary circumstances, and it just seemed like an unusual requirement to put on this organization.
Mr. Strom, it seems to me that you mentioned at one point that there were some organizations that we have given money to that we don't make this requirement of. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members, as Mr. Lehrer pointed out, there are a variety of contracts that the state enters into, and some of those contracts are with nonprofit organizations. Those organizations generally don't have any tie-in to a statutory creation. They're not subject to things like the open meeting law. Instead, if they're a nonprofit, they're subject to the laws that govern nonprofits. As you asked earlier, there are some some organizations that have been created by the state, such as the Youth Works, where the state puts specific requirements on them in regard to their meetings. There are other organizations that are slightly different than that, but it's fairly unusual for the state to actually essentially create the shell for an organization in the K-12 area.
Okay.
And Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Kelly.
And Madam Chair, we had some debate a couple years back about municipalities and other local units of government creating corporations in order to carry out their purposes. And I think in the statute that addresses that, we also had some language regarding having those corporations be subject to some of these same accountability mechanisms, but I can't remember that precisely enough now. So in one sense, Mr. Lehrer, we're trying to be somewhat consistent, even though the variety of organizations and sort of the spectrum on which they have relationships with the state makes it hard to figure out where any particular organization should fit as we work with them. So.
Madam Chair and Senator, we appreciate that.
Mr. Lehrer, thank you. I think we'll just move on with our agenda. I think we've had several questions answered here. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for listening.
And our next item on the agenda is a statewide school employee health insurance plan. We have a number of people who would ask to testify. I'm going to ask each of you to, you know, try and keep your remarks relatively brief. And starting with AMSD, Dennis Fent, Teachers Union President from the North St. Paul Maplewood Oakdale School District. Is he here?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
See, I want the colleague who has to attend a funeral. Would it be possible for him to go first? He needs...
Oh, I maybe don't have his name. Who is that?
George Kramer.
George Kramer. I don't even have your name, George, so you may come up followed by Mr. Fent. And Mr. Kramer, please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is George Kramer, and I represent the Watertown Mayor, teachers, and school board. Would you like me to just proceed then? Is that okay?
Sure.
I'd appreciate it.
Exactly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The discussion about mandated statewide health insurance for all public school employees has taken up a great deal of your precious time in the last two sessions. It's clear that this is a difficult decision for all of you. Why is this decision so difficult for you to make? It's difficult because there's absolutely no consensus on the bill as it's written. One powerful organization, Education Minnesota, is pushing this legislation with all of its might. Many of the other stakeholders are against it. Even several of Education Minnesota locals have expressed their opposition to this bill, including my own and my colleague. Why do we oppose it? There are winners and losers in this bill. Watertown Mayor is in the 50% of districts that would lose if this bill becomes law. In the actuarial studies that were grouped by region, I looked at where we sat and where others sat in our region. The cost of the premium was in a range of $200 per month per member, up to $450. It's a very significant difference. We were the $200 per month per member. Another district in our region is paying $450, more than twice as much. Okay, what this bill does, though, is it squeezes everything to the mean, and that's what the gentleman that was talking to you last week was telling you that. They're trying to get it down to a very narrow range, about 5% range. So if, in fact, after 4 years, this bill becomes law, and after 4 years, assuming no change in experience in either district, Watertown mayor would then be paying $340 instead of $200. The district that was paying $450 would be paying $380, assuming no change in experience of the people in that insurance plan. So what they've done is they've squeezed the premium difference from 200% difference to 12% between the two districts. This is great for the high premium district. They can continue to spend large amounts of health insurance dollars, and the low premium district can continue to be frugal, only to see their premiums increase by 60%. The low premium district, my district, would, if we were to remain in the educational service cooperative unit, would see only a 30% increase over those 4 years, if we just went with our average past increases. So just that alone is very troubling. The other troubling aspect of this bill is that it imposes a new tax on Watertown Mayor's schools that it does not pay at the present time. Because we are part of a self-insured regional co-op pool, we do not pay the Minnesota CARE tax. All of the other districts that are part of the self-insured co-ops do not pay this tax. How good can this bill be if it imposes a new tax on a tax-supported entity? Are there alternatives to this bill that would aid those districts struggling with excessively high premiums? My recommendation would be that rather than create a huge new bureaucracy that is governed by non-elected officials, they should use the educational service regional pools for those districts that are very small. We could organize a task force to determine how high premium districts can become part of their regional pool. The large districts, such as Minneapolis, have apparently been able to work out cost-effective arrangements with commercial insurance companies. Please vote no on this bill, and let's get busy finding solutions that will be good for all school districts of Minnesota. Do you have any questions?
Thank you very much, Mr. Kramer. I think what we'll do, since you aren't going to be here later, if there's a quick question for Mr. Kramer, we'll take it now. Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, Mr. Kramer, and maybe it's a question I should have clarified when Mr. Hoffman was testifying, but my understanding was that when he was talking about narrowing the differential, he was, since the plan specifically references having the pool would have multiple plans underneath it, that districts, depending on what the cost profile, what they negotiated with their bargaining units, would be in different plans, and that there could be a relatively high level of variation from one plan to the next, but that it was within each plan that he was talking about trying to narrow the pricing differential. Because you could envision that there'd be a relatively low-cost plan, a relatively high-cost plan, significant price differential between the two. And it would be up to the bargaining unit and the district to decide which plan they would go into. And so when you were talking about squeezing everybody into one shoe, that didn't seem to me the plan, that was not consistent with my understanding.
Madam Chair, Senator Kelly.
Mr. Kramer.
I think between the two of us here, we've got a fairly good understanding of this. The way that study was laid out was they said, okay, assuming that both of these districts have Plan 1, this is the cost. So they kind of said, okay, exactly what you're saying. If you have a real high-buck plan and a real low, then this it's apples to oranges. So they tried to make it apples to apples. So that $450 and that $200 was apples to apples. It was Plan 1 in the other district, and it was Plan 1 in Watertown Mayor. Is that correct? Or?
Correct. Madam Chair, Senator Kelly, just briefly to respond to that question, because I think it's an excellent question. Mr. Earl Hoffman was here last week, spoke about the program that he wrote, the study that he wrote, the Redden and Anders study. I've been through it numerous times. I don't know how many times you've been through it. One of the major fears, Senator Kelly, that we all have, if you look at that study, In the executive summary, on page 11, item number 11, it states, after an initial transition period, and that was referred to last week, the new pool's governing body should consider how many plans the pool should offer or whether the pool should move to a single plan. As a matter of fact, one of the recommendations, strong recommendations coming out of that study, was to eventually move to a single state plan. So although initially it's required to have at least six, which they do, at least brief prototypes, the concern is, and I will address that later, that eventually is there one plan, and which plan is that, and what does that do to all school employees across the state? Senator Kelly, I hope that helps to that answer or explain one of the major fears that there's a strong possibility will become reality.
Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, I understand that point about what might happen, but given at least what I know about the variety of plan designs, differences from region to region even, the question of how many plan designs there will be to choose from, it strikes me, will be sort of a market question within the pool. That is, if you start out offering six and only one district picks plan number four, at some point you're going to say it's not worth it to offer plan number four, but you might have a fairly decent spread of districts across all the rest of the five plans that are available within the pool. And so because you've got takers across all the rest of them, you'd probably maintain those plan designs because there's a market for them within the pool.
That's, of course, possible.
You know, Mr. Fent, you never really introduced yourself. Would you do that for the record,
yes,
please?
Yes, I will, and I apologize. My name is Dennis Fent. I'm a teacher in North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale School District. I've been a teacher since 1973. I'm also the president of the North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale Education Association, representing over 750 teachers in that organization. I also am on the 622 District 622 Insurance Committee, which is staffed by members from all bargaining units in our district. And again, I apologize for the request I made earlier. I'm sure I did it inappropriately, but I know George was concerned about getting to that.
That's all right. I know that Mr. Kramer had to leave, and so we will let you go ahead and do your testimony. Thank you very much, Mr. Kramer.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. I thought Education Minnesota was adamant last week that this is a pooling plan, not a health care plan. So I think we should be talking about pooling, not health care plans.
You know, Representative Erickson, it may be a pooling plan, but there's a lot of health insurance in that pool from what I can gather. So I think this is very appropriate. go ahead, Mr. Fent, with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I already stated for you, the positions that I hold, I do want you to know, as I hold those positions, first of all, as I said, I represent over 750 teachers who oppose this plan. I've talked to numerous other local presidents who also oppose this plan. In fact, many of our neighboring local presidents oppose it as well. As a matter of fact, there are local presidents and local unions around the state that vehemently oppose this plan. Again, on our insurance committee, not only do the teachers oppose it, the principals oppose it, the paras, the ed assistants, the custodians, the bus drivers. About 3 months ago, they took a unanimous vote to oppose the statewide plan that is being mandated and imposed upon them. I I guess one of the common themes I hear as I talk to other elected officials and other teachers is that if this was a good plan, it wouldn't have to be mandated. If this was a good plan, sooner or later, everyone would be in it. The problem is, this isn't a good plan, nor is this good public policy. My mother used to say to me, you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. This statewide plan, very simply, is a sow's ear. Last week, when Mr. Hoffman reviewed with you the Redden and Anders report, the amazing thing to me is the number of questions that couldn't be answered. I wondered who would move forward with a plan with so many unanswered questions. For example, we heard about the phantom savings. 37% of the savings come from MCHA. Guess what? Due to an amendment in the Senate, those savings are now gone. Beyond that, for those districts that currently do not pay MCHA, this will impose upon them a whole new tax that they have not paid in the past. 29% of the savings came from limited selection. So much for local control. In fact, Mr. Hoffman's words, these savings are obtained by eliminating freedom of choice. That statement appalls me, and I think any of us in a legislative body in the United States of America, moving forward to eliminate freedom of choice, we ought to take a second look. There were other savings, such as 24% from risk charges, later some of those to be refunded and lost, 10% from brokers and agent fees, even though most locals don't use brokers or agents. It went on to ask, what does this larger pool plan, whichever it is we want to call it, do in a positive way? It doesn't affect trend in any way. In fact, only 2/10 of 1% of the savings is from premium savings of the plan. What does it do? It does create winners and losers. In fact, it creates more losers than winners. It does create new tax for many districts. It does now have 6 prototypes, the best of which does not provide the coverage of our current plan. Would the state impose upon us an inferior plan? If management were to unilaterally reduce the aggregate value of a plan, legal action would follow. In fact, Ed Minnesota lawyers would be representing the locals harmed. When aggregate value is reduced for locals across the state, my question is, can Ed Minnesota bring legal action against itself, or will that action be brought against the state if this become law? If it states the larger pool, the more savings, question that, please. Why then is our premium in District 622 $200 less than the current CGIP rate, even though they have a much, much larger pool, and even though we have superior coverage to that provided by CGIP? It suggests that the 6 prototypes that are there and are currently ill-defined without a specific price tag attached to them at this time probably will lead to fewer options at some time, maybe even one plan design, as I read to you earlier from page 11, item number 11 from the Redden and Anders study. At that point, which plan is left? Do we all get the cheapest and most inferior plan? It suggests that districts are just one catastrophe away from disaster. I would suggest to you That's why they purchased stop-loss coverage, and most all districts, of course, would do that. It suggests that it's good public policy when, in fact, it rewards those who have least been good custodians of their health care plan and penalizes those who have been successful in managing their plan. Remember, as you decide, that this discussion is about health care for us and our loved ones. Healthcare is rated as the most important benefit our members receive on their job. Are you willing to chase these phantom savings to mandate this plan upon school employees across the state? Thank you very much for your time. And again, I also would be happy to stand for questions.
Mr. Fent, I think what we'll do, we've got a number of people who wanted to testify, and we'll go to questions afterwards, assuming we have enough time.
Again, thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you. Ms. Klinger. And again, I would ask each of you to be as brief as possible and still, you know, make your good points.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paula Klinger. I'm the president of Hopkins Education Association, representing 715 teachers. I also sit on the district-wide insurance committee that is incorporates all the different bargaining units in our district, and I've done so for several years. The question always comes up, why does health care continue to rise? And, of course, those answers to that question are very numerous. But at least one of the problems is lack of personal commitment to make the best possible choices to guarantee that each and every health dollar is well spent. We in Hopkins have successfully worked to manage consumer responsibility and have been able to keep our rates lower and have, for the past 2 years, had a 0% rate hike in premiums. If our success story is swallowed up by this legislation, you will be doing a great disservice to our initiatives and those initiatives of other districts around the state. Why are we opposed to the statewide plan? We don't see that this plan has a clear funding source. The plan has costs that will be passed on to each participant that will raise our premiums. The plan's earlier predictions of savings would be compromised, as Mr. Fent has mentioned. The plan allows local districts only to bargain what the district will pay towards premiums and not be creative with what they do in their own plans. The plan takes other local controls away. If the statewide group plan turns out to be a lousy situation, we have no chance to make changes. We will be forced to accept what is offered. The statewide plan does not define coverage very clearly. Is the state held harmless, by the way, in the new plan? Would any liability fall back onto individual districts? If so, the districts would have no local control to manage that situation, but will be liable if there is trouble. That's just amazing. We in Hopkins are deeply embedded in the losers list. We've worked hard to and creatively to manage health care costs in our districts and to create plans that respond to local needs. We wish to continue that good work. And we actually resent the idea that that good work should be ignored, chastised, or swallowed into an abyss. Hopkins would lose, could lose its ability to work on a wellness program, as the district really doesn't have the dollars to commit to that, to support that work. We currently support it with our creative plans. A huge reality we must all face is that districts have been underfunded for several years. There's a fairly limited pot of money to use for salaries and benefits, and districts are reluctant to put huge amounts of, or sometimes even any amounts of money, into benefits. A statewide plan that provides plans for all employees will not solve the problems districts are having. It will not guarantee that any district will pay for anyone's plan. Yes, that sort of thing is negotiated, but some places will have huge challenges negotiating enough dollars to provide health care. If they aren't providing them now, why will that change? That could still leave many, many employees with huge premium costs and exacerbate rather than fix the problem. Negotiating a contract is a very challenging situation for both sides. There's a delicate balance between salary and benefits. One goes up, the other goes down. Districts won't be able to absorb the increases in premiums, and the plan will seriously compromise the bargaining process, or could. It could create great mischief. Teachers are not making huge wages. If you vote this in and the premiums raised for thousands of public school employees, for example, just by $100 a month, for those on single coverage, that would be $1,200 a year, which would mean for beginning teachers, it would be a 4% wage reduction. That would be even more serious for folks who are not on teacher salaries. If you vote this in and the premiums raised, they could raise as much as $400 a month for families, or $4,800 a year, which would be a 13% reduction in wages for young teachers just starting with families and about 5 years into their careers. I believe that the mischief this could cause is that teachers will find it even harder to remain in this profession. This will cause greater pressure on their families. Some families who currently have insurance may choose no insurance if the hikes become so great. And this can really stress retired folks, the seniors who have not yet reached Medicare and who are counting on the current situation. This legislation is flawed. It has winners and losers. It's good for the winners, of course, but it has so many, many losers, and that is very, very bad. The question is, 170 districts were named as losers, and they will experience premium hikes and possible reduction in services because of this legislation. But how many people does this represent, the 170 districts? If it's 100 people a district, that's 17,000 people across the state. If it's 1,000 people per district, that's 170,000. And how many families will that involve? There seems to be an underlying assumption that the premiums will be lower because of this statewide health insurance plan. I personally believe that to be false. On the contrary, by their own reports, the premiums for those 170 districts will be raised. The plan does not create ways to actually control the overall health costs. And will this be funded by the state so that no person required to participate will be guaranteed no hikes in premiums? Not likely. If not, then this becomes...
Don't count on it.
Don't count on it? Darn. Then this becomes essentially another unfunded mandate, and it's really a violation of rights. If large bureaucratic health plans were the answer with huge pools, then... How can the lack of stellar success of other state plans currently in existence be? An international company with hundreds of thousands of employees across the nation and internationally currently pays an average of $8,900 per employee per year. That's $742 a month. And that is significantly higher. And that's an enormous pool. Our system of government is about choice and self-determination. It is not about dictatorship. It is your charge to provide, not to dictate and cause harm. It is your charge to encourage creative management, not to destroy it. Please vote no on mandatory state health. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Klinger. I will go on to Becky Perlick. Would you please introduce yourself, Ms. Perlick?
Madam Chair, I am Becky Perlick. I'm coming from the Rochester Schools Insurance Office. I'm here representing the district's health plan in opposition of the statewide health plan proposal for school district employees. Our health plan is currently self-insured and self-administered. With over 1,900 employee contracts, we insure approximately 3,600 members. The district does not support the mandatory statewide school health proposal for several reasons. Creating this pool does not address the increasing medical costs we face. It is clearly a cost-shifting program. The study indicates that a 4.1 reduction to plan's overall costs during the next 6 years. 4% savings over 6 years is not substantial, especially in light of the benefits that we stand to lose. A large portion of the savings, 37%, are a result of the pool not paying premium taxes and MSHA assessments. This, too, is a cost shift to smaller private employers and fully insured who will be forced to fund the programs. Our plan is self-insured, therefore we currently do not pay these premium taxes nor assessments. Our plan will see no savings on this, nor will we or any other currently self-insured district. The proposal references reductions in administrative and stop-loss fees as being the second largest component in cost reduction. Under the plan, we currently average approximately 6% in administrative costs. This is significantly less than many self-insured plans whose typical fixed costs account for 10 to 15% of overall costs. Therefore, we would again see no savings but likely increased costs to our plan. Increased administrative costs will be incurred by our district having to pay the pool's administrative fees, as well as continuing to locally administer eligibility, membership, COBRA, and HIPAA requirements of the health plan's administrative duties as required by federal law. The proposal references $3 million in startup expenses the first year. Not included in this cost are run-out claim administration, loading of history and accumulators from previous carriers to track and maintain plan lifetime maximums, and respond to claim appeals. These are additional costs each district will again have to absorb. The study states that pharmacy savings will come from two sources. The first, from increasing use of formulary and generic drugs. Our plan has very high utilization of formulary and generic drugs. Again, no savings to our plan. The second is by increasing the amount of manufacturer rebates from the pharmaceutical vendors. Last year, we received over $105,000 in pharmacy rebates. So as a self-insured, unbranded product of Blue Cross Blue Shield, we already administer our plans to experience these savings. Being forced into a mandated statewide health plan will not be of benefit to our district. In addition to it being more costly to our district, our members will likely be limited to their provider choice and will lose benefits that have been an essential part of the successful plan. For our members to seek treatment in downtown Mayo as they currently do, they will be likely charged a greater cost sharing. Our members will either be limited on their provider options or incur additional costs. We have been successful in creating a sound plan of benefits for our members to include preventative care, to identify health concerns early for treatment, and now are being punished by the threat of being mandated into a statewide plan. It will no longer be their plan, and without their ownership, they will have little incentive to promote wellness and implement healthy lifestyle changes. Another point of concern of our district is the proposal of creating an additional special plan for retirees. This plan would be promoted on the premise of lower premiums for the special plan. But along with lower premiums in this plan comes greater cost sharing. While it is true that retirees' income has changed when they are no longer an active employee, but a substantial reality is once they reach retirement age, that is when they need benefits. That is when health care concerns often surface and to offer them decreased benefits with higher out-of-pocket expenses on their part is unfair. The idea behind this special plan for retirees is simply to discourage them from staying on the plan. They won't be able to afford their own retirement health benefits. With rates being based on actual costs, the problem is overall spending. Therefore, educating consumers is a key to reducing costs. Keep the districts in control of their health plans to partner with their members and their providers to meet the members' needs. Smaller, struggling districts can be encouraged to join service co-ops for purchasing power if needed. By mandating a statewide health plan, I think employees believe that this will remove the benefit piece from the negotiation table and that additional dollars will be freed up for salaries. This certainly will not be the case, especially in our situation where the administrative costs will be increasing. Allow us to remain self-insured and administer our plans according to our members' needs. If you believe pooling is actually an answer to the health care spending, then provide the districts that are stable and opt out and make this plan voluntary. From the Durenberger document, our districts know that the statewide members want cost-effective, quality health care for all Minnesotans, and these initiatives can be achieved through local control, not by more mandates. Please do not force us into a mandated statewide plan. Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Perlick.
We're going to take all the questions after.
We're going to bring you all back up for questions afterwards, assuming we can get through these folks quickly. Thank you very much. Lisa Wagner and Carter Peterson, would you both come up at the same time, please? Ms. Wagner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Wagner, and I'm here today to speak to you in opposition to the proposed mandatory statewide school employee health insurance. I'm here both as a former human resources executive and as a mother with children in public schools. After hearing the testimony last week, I felt compelled to be here today, even though I'm paying a babysitter to do so, because I wanted to represent the many parents who couldn't be here today to tell you about their concerns about this proposal. First of all, as a former human resource executive, I was responsible for benefits plan design and contract negotiation, and I have seen firsthand that the most successful benefits plans involve ownership by the entities and employees and families they serve, as well as a strong emphasis on wellness and preventative care. As an aside, I want to stop here and mention that I specifically wanted to say families here, because it's very critical when you're looking at insurance plans that you look not only at the employees that they will serve, but the dependents that will also be impacted. And that's also known as lives in insurance jargon and has a great deal to do with how much the plans cost. Emphasis on wellness and employee involvement creates a motivation for judicious use of health care that is not only financially driven, but is also driven by creating a vested interest in the success of the plan through ownership of it. True long-term health care savings come from changes in lifestyles and health habits. In the case of schools, this translates to local control of health care. Certainly, some districts may need assistance in the benefits area, and allowing them to opt into existing state employee health insurance or other co-op plans should provide a workable option. However, in other districts, such a pool or a plan would be financially detrimental. In 2000, Minnetonka, Wayzata, and Hopkins implemented self-insured plans. Working with long-standing employee health insurance advisory committees, all of them focused on developing employee responsibility for judicious use of health care and on wellness. For the past 2 years, all have had single-digit rate increases. In fact, Minnetonka had no rate increase in 04-05, and in 05-06, rates will only increase by 2.2%. This trend is evidence of the power of local control. Now, all this insurance lingo may seem like a foreign language to some people. Benefits plans typically involve complexities and a great deal of jargon. That is why I want to comment on this issue as a mother. As a mother of public school children, I am disturbed by the discussion of a statewide employee health insurance mandate on two fronts. First of all, it will be a financial detriment to my district, where budget cuts have occurred in 8 of the last 10 years, and will pull money away from where it is needed most, directly serving the children. Then most importantly, secondly, this whole discussion diverts resolution of the economic crisis faced by Minnesota schools. Education should be the one thing that is truly nonpartisan. What the legislature should focus on now is not the politicking surrounding adults' benefits, but the legacy of Minnesota as a leader in education and the education of Minnesota's kids. This can be done simply. Steer clear of a statewide employee health insurance mandate and drive for quick and balanced resolution of the E-12 Education Finance Omnibus Bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wagner. And Ms. Peterson.
Carter Peterson, Wayzata School Board. It's kind of interesting. I'm the only school board person. And the one thing we hear all the time is, and especially from all you, is for us to hold the line. Okay? Well, we have held the line in Wayzata. We have a great success story going, and which our other districts do too. We are self-insured. This came about because our staff and our administrators sat down, and they worked for 3 long years to figure out how to do this. I mean, part of the reason is the staff knew that unless we brought it under control, that there wouldn't be money left for salary increases. And I don't know about anybody else, but has anybody else watched their property tax bill lately? Well, that's the money that we've saved that they can now use to pay the property tax bill. We are now self-insured. Our first year that we weren't, we were 20%, and we're going into our 5th year. So let's go back. 20% the first year, 5.30%, and next year is 4.6%. To do that, our staff is paying, just at our lowest level, is paying $250 out of their money totally, and after that they pay $25 per visit and some money towards prescription. We would like to keep this local. As a result, if we keep it local, our staff works very hard not to spend health care dollars. We know they only do it when absolutely needed. A statewide plan, our fear is that goes away, and as a result, it takes away one more thing that we can manage. Again, getting back to what you guys have said to us, Many times I've heard this. Try to keep your costs under control. We are trying. So what we're saying also is if you want to do this, just make it voluntary, please.
Thank you very much. Let's see. You both have been wonderful, brief and to the point. You're done for the moment. I'm trying to get through this so that we will be able to have questioning. Mr. Bloom. Mr. Bloom, would you please introduce yourself and your position, please?
My name is Bill Blum. I'm a consulting actuary with Milliman. I've been hired to, on behalf of the St. Cloud Service Co-op, to review the Redden and Andrews report and provide commentary on it. I am a fellow of the Society of Actuaries, member of the American Academy of Actuaries, fellow of the Conference of Actuaries. I have the honor to currently be serving as the president of the Conference of Consulting Actuaries, and would be glad to provide other details on my background if anybody has an interest. We were hired in the latter part of 2003 to review the Redden and Andrews report and see whether, from an actuarial point of view, there were any significant issues with that report. There were. We provided those in a letter from January 2004, which many of you may have seen. We'd be glad to provide additional copies. And I'm just here today to run through the major elements of that. Most of the projected savings that were projected came from four sources. The first was avoidance of premium tax and assessments. That first source, I understand, has been changed in the current legislation so that that is no longer projected savings. The second is reduced administrative costs because of the increased pool size and benefit simplification. I would suggest that it is not as clear as it sounds that there will be savings from that, let alone substantial savings. Having a smaller number of plans may or may not translate to cost savings, depending on whether those smaller number of plans are consistent with the systems that the carrier has, the way providers are paid, the way enrollment is tracked, those sorts of issues. There would certainly be a significant transition startup cost to build the systems necessary to manage this program. The third source was reduced cost from savings on stop loss, and the fourth was reduced cost because of lower risk charges. In both of those cases, I know the service co-ops had already, as of 2004 when we wrote this, had already negotiated lower costs for both of those elements than were being projected as the low costs that the program could achieve. So it's hard to count those as savings when they would be there actually would be a higher cost. One of the significant issues is this rate stabilization reserve. The rate stabilization reserve target that is proposed in the report is under 10%. At that level, if this were actually an insured health plan, that it was licensed by the state to take that risk, they would the state insurance department would be authorized to require the plan to come up with a program to strengthen it because that's such a weak stabilization reserve. It would be my judgment that that if the state is not liable, as I understand the current legislation says, that this would create a higher level of risk and might necessitate an even higher level of stabilization reserve. On the administrative expenses, I know the report had the Redden and Andrews had done a non-binding request for information to get quotes from a variety of sources, including TPAs and insurers, and got a wide variety of quoted administrative costs back that ran from 5% to 8%, I believe. And that doesn't make a lot of sense to me unless that 5 to 8%, and this is my conclusion based on what I've read in the report, is that those represent quite different levels of service being provided between those administrators charging 5% and those charging 8%. And I would suggest that it might not be logical to assume you can achieve something close to the bottom end of that range and at the same time getting the level of services that are at the top end of that range. One other point on the pooling issue, the rate pooling issue, this is a collapsing of rates along a number of variables that most insurance plans vary rates for. It's important to understand that that's a permanent change, that the plans that are low cost, who will be paying a higher cost because of pooling in order to subsidize the high cost plans, that subsidy will be a permanent subsidy. The low cost plans will every year will be paying those subsidies. Another issue is that the because of the eligibility, there may be rating inequities caused by the change in the eligibility changes. And finally, I think it's not clear to me how the retirees are going to be handled. Early retirees that are included under these plans that have. If this community rating program is kind of a socialized pooling program, if it takes place, does it also include the subsidy of early retirees in some plans who aren't in others, and thereby create perhaps some inequities in that, as I say, in the eligibility? So that's it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, sir. Are you going to be able to stay around for a few minutes? Because I think we will have some time for questions.
Sure.
Okay. Mr. Brinkman. Welcome, Mr. Brinkman. Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Paul Brinkman. I currently serve as Executive Director of the Northeast Service Cooperative, serving Northeast Minnesota. We're based out of Mountain Iron. The map we're sending around is a map of the state of Minnesota, and it shows dots for each of the 650 members we have voluntarily serving in our pools. 260 or so of these members are school districts. We want to remind you that our program is voluntary, it's flexible, it's proven, it's member-driven, as we've seen today, and to date, we're fortunate it leads the market, particularly in rural Minnesota, where our market penetration runs around 80%. As you know, in fairness, I should add that these are all things that the proposed legislation before you these past 2 to 3 years hopes to someday incorporate into a mandatory statewide system. However, we're doing all these things today under a voluntary model with the involvement, support, and ownership of over 265 school districts. And when we can't do the job, a district can walk. It's an innovative, adaptive, voluntary model. One size does not fit all. On behalf of our members, Madam Chair, the service cooperatives appreciate this opportunity to address the committee in the critical hours of your work today. Thank you.
Wow, that was brief, Mr. Brinkman.
That's what you wanted, Madam Chair. We're here to make you happy.
Thank you.
Thank
there
you.
Aren't many people who are here to make us happy, I don't think. Is there Mr. Fahey here?
Thank you.
Faye. Welcome, Mr. Faye.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Faye, and I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota School Employees Association, an independent union representing classified school employees throughout the state of Minnesota. We have, I believe, 58 units representing 80 contracts and 80 contracts and 57 school districts throughout the state, from rural to urban. In fact, we represent the Rochester paraeducators, who are in fully support of the proposal passed by the Senate and the statewide health care plan. We represent the confidential secretaries in the school district of St. Paul, again, who are in fully support of the Senate bill, the proposal for the statewide health insurance pool. In fact, none of our unit chapters has taken a position in opposition to the Minnesota School Employees Association's Board of Directors and actions by our Delegate Assembly to oppose the proposal. And even though that we are an independent union, we stand in concert with our friends in that belong to the Minnesota State AFL-CIO and the other school unions, AFSCME Education Minnesota, and the Service Employees International Union, in proposing and being an proponent of the Betzel-Davis bill. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, many of the members of my organization are part-time workers. We've heard a lot today, and we've heard a lot in other testimony about innovative, consumer-driven healthcare plans that really amount to cost-shifting. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, when you're a part-time bus driver making $6,500 a year, a proposal to have a $2,500 deductible health insurance plan means you do not have insurance. At one of the Senate committees, a member of mine, a Patty Gunderson from the St. Cloud School District, a paraeducator, testified that she pays $7,000 a year in health insurance for her family on a $14,000 salary. The status quo is broken. Now, this is not a global fix of the entire healthcare problem in America. The people that are who are charged in fixing that have failed to do so. But this is a proposal that will make health insurance more affordable to the high-quality people who serve our children and our school districts represented by my union. There have been a number of remarks made by opponents of this about pooling. I mean, you don't have to be any smarter than me to know that that pooling, the largest pools, get the best rates by experience. There's been a number of comments made or questions brought up about the governing board that is described during the bill. This is simply, in the manner of a Taft-Hartley insurance trust, a recognized efficient model for the last 55 years that has been as successful as any model of labor management relations. I'm not here to question the motivation of any opponent of this proposal. I would never do that. That's certainly not my job. But I will tell you what my motivation is. My motivation is because my members have told me, and my board of directors have told me, and my staff have told me, pulling other unions representing that negotiate with school districts every day have also told me that this is the only game in town right now. This is the only proposal that is the difference between hard-working school employees having insurance for their families and not having insurance for their families. If someone came up with a better proposal than the status quo, I'm sure it would be codified in legislation and it would be before you. It is not. They have not. For all their platitudes about what mother said and about living a healthy lifestyle. We all have those in our health care plans. We have wellness provisions in the health care plan of my union, of which I participate. The fact is, health care costs are out of control. They're going to continue to be out of control, and the limited cost shifting that we've seen in the marketplace over the last few years does nothing to stop that. I'm not here to offer a global answer for the health insurance problems we have in America. They may be out there. I don't have them. You don't have them before you. What you have before you is the result of a report that was conceived out of trying to do something on a scale that would help out school employees, would help out school district, local property tax payers, and would help out the state of Minnesota, and that's what I urge you to support. Thank you very, very much, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the opportunity to appear in front of you.
Thank you, sir. I think we'll start, since you're at the table, we'll leave you there, Mr. Brinkman. Pardon me, Mr. Fay, ask Mr. Brinkman, Mr. Bloom to also come up, and we'll spend 10 minutes, questions there, and then we'll go back to some of the other folks and have a few minutes for questions there. So I would ask questioners, please not to give a 15-minute dissertation before your question. And people who are answering, if you would just keep them brief, please, your responses. Senator Kelly.
Well, Madam Chair, I think appreciate Mr. Blum's testimony. I think the challenge for the legislature is that since we have to pay attention to the cost of the whole system, if there's a reasonable chance of saving significant amounts of dollars by having a mandatory pool as opposed to a voluntary statewide pool, that we have to pay attention to that. On the other hand, if it seems unlikely that there's any collective savings, then there's a challenge making the case that we should do this because of the winners and losers, that we're just shifting costs from one group of employees to another. But if there's a net savings in the systems, in the whole system, that's a hard temptation to resist, to try to realize that collective savings. So I get this, you know, my sense is that with options among the plans in a bigger pool, Minnesota is still, we have different healthcare markets. Trying to do a comparison to a national provider doesn't make sense to me because healthcare costs on the whole are much higher in Florida than they are here. But Minnesota is still a coherent enough healthcare marketplace that it's reasonable to look at the state as a whole. A larger plan seems to me likely to get us some savings collectively. They may not be as big as the savings specified in the Redden and Anders report, but if it's $100 million over 5 years, that's a significant amount of money collectively in the system.
Thank you for that brief question, Senator Kelly.
Well, Madam Chair, I tried to stay focused on
what is the
key issue. So, do you think there are zero savings in doing a statewide plan, or are there some?
I don't know whether there are or not. Madam Chair, we have not tried to do our own quantification of it. The savings to be had through the administrative savings, economies of scale, are probably relatively minor given the size of this, that there's 300 school districts now. It's very different than saying there are 10,000 entities who are being grouped together. Making it a mandatory pool doesn't do anything for cost savings other than make the pool bigger, but it has to be mandatory under the pooling mechanism. Otherwise, the low cost plans wouldn't participate. So I see that as it's just an issue of increasing the size of the pool, which I don't believe buys all that much. It does. One of the drawbacks of that is that it does. I was talking about the rate stabilization pool. It makes the one big plan a little more cumbersome. It takes a little longer to get from through the rating process, say from the beginning of the analysis. You have more entities involved. You have to go through more process to get to the point of where you can start implementing rates. That raises the risk to the whole plan. So actually, even though you're pooling more, you're reducing that element of risk because of pool size. That's relatively minor in comparison to the major risk of not being able to react quickly enough because you've slowed things down.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Representative Han?
Senator Han.
Senator, excuse me. You're sitting on the representative side.
I'm on the representative side, and I'm not a member of the committee, and I appreciate your, if it's permissible, I'd like to ask a question of Mr. Blum, if that's allowable under your rules. But, Mr. Blum, I just, in the language of the bill, the proposed bill, it talks about the function of the board and what the board's activities must be. And one of the things it talks about is a board may establish more than one tier of premium rates for any specific plan. Plans and premium rates may vary across geographic regions established by the board. And I'm just wondering, in your experience, is this typical for how rates are established? Do boards, when they establish insurance rates, as they're looking at, it doesn't really get into how those rates are established. Seems to me that there's some actuarial things that need to be done. Would this suggest that those aren't being done? Or how would this compare to what a typical insurance plan would be governed and how they would set rates?
Mr. Blum.
Most health plans will take into account every rating factor that they can find that is relevant and credible, and those generally include demographic factors of the population, age, gender. It will include area, typically down to say 3-digit zip code. It will include what network they're choosing or they're involved in. It may include what plan elements there are that lead to savings or not, such as high deductibles, which will cause more consumer direction of care, and those sort of things. Anytime you intentionally restrict the ability to reflect those factors, you create a potential for anti-selection. That there will be anti-selection is when somebody who knows better about their own health or what their group's going to cost can make choices based on knowing that information, and the insurance company can't use that same information in their rating. So that's why I was commenting on the mandatory nature that low-cost school districts, if they weren't forced to be part of a pooling plan, would leave and get lower cost coverage somewhere else where somebody will reflect it. So anytime you start squeezing that, there is that potential, and then those the more you squeeze it, the bigger the potential is.
Are there any further questions for any of these three gentlemen? Hearing none, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
If necessary, we'll call you back up.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Madam Chair?
Yes,
could
Senator.
I just make a brief remark? Many of the witnesses talked about, they kept using the word statewide plan, and I know the working group understands the concept, but it's a statewide pool, which was used by some of the witnesses, with at least six plans, and if, as was discussed last week, if the working group feels that the language isn't quite tight enough to guarantee that there must always be at least six plans, obviously you have that opportunity to do that. But we heard about winners and losers, and you have to remember today's winners are tomorrow's losers and vice versa. And even a self-insured plan can get hit with some pretty catastrophic risks, and that's why, you know, every school district and state could go self-insured, but there's reasons why they don't want to do that. The actuarial study that you received did discuss the fact that premiums are going to rise, and whether you have a statewide pool or you don't have one, they are going to rise. Obviously, it is in all of our interests to have wellness plans and so forth. We need to take personal responsibility to do it. But if there's no pool, premiums are going to rise, and we have to do more to bring them down. And this in and of itself doesn't guarantee that, and I don't think anybody's represented that this in and of itself is going to automatically drive down costs. It may help keep them in check for a while. But anyway, that's just some of my observation, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Betzold. All right, could we please have... Pardon? Are there questions for Ms. Perlick, Ms. Wagner, or Ms. Peterson from members of the committee?
Can I say one more thing? I'm sorry.
Ms. Peterson has an additional comment or question.
Person that has to deal with this from a management point of view in the district. One thing I have to say to you guys, and I live next door to a former head of the state AMA, so we've had long discussions about health care. And one of the things that we've both concluded is a lot of people think health care is free. They walk in and they go, oh, well, that'll take care of it because my employer will take care of it. One of the wonderful things in Wayzata, and it sounds like the other, because we're local and it's there, and it sounds like Rochester and everybody, you know, other places where there's local control of it. People are choosing not to take, they're choosing to take the generics. I mean, because it is local. My fear is you go to a statewide plan and you lose all that. And because people say, so-and-so's getting it, why not me? I mean, at this point, they're looking at each other and saying, if I don't take it, I don't expect you to take it. It's been wonderful. That's all we're asking for. Keep us with local control. I'm done. Sorry. Any questions? Senator Kelly. Oh,
Madam Chair, Ms. Peterson.
Yes.
Another
school board member's here. No.
One of the reasons for talking about having multiple plans within the pool.
Right.
Is to, for example, provide as one of the plan design options a VEBA-type plan of the kind that Hopkins and Wayzata and others have adopted. So I don't think anybody's trying to suggest that we should take away the option to have that plan design. We're trying to determine whether we can save costs on a statewide collective basis by pooling folks together and using the bargaining power that goes with the larger pool to make gains for the system as a whole.
You know, I understand that, but I'm just...
Peterson.
Sorry. I'm the person that has to answer to the voters. You do too. I'm sorry. But we're the people. You might give us 5%. You might give us 4%. I'm not sure what will happen. This plan goes through. We take money off the top. Okay, right there. You have the new pension thing. Again, that takes money off the top. Okay? Then we end up just maybe making teacher salary increases. Again, getting back to our property tax increases, which we're all facing, especially where we are. And suddenly we're going to have everybody looking at us and going, well, we gave you 5%. And we're going to go, yeah, but we didn't really get anything. I mean, we can't. What we're hoping we will get, we've been cutting for years. I mean, we're just so, in many ways, I can't tell you how tired my district is. We don't have an assistant of anything. Our people are working full out on everything, okay? We're hoping to get back to add a little thing here, a little there, and to give people an increase in salary. We're all up against teachers. We're just saying, please let us stay local. That's our job. That's what we're elected to do. Is to keep it and keep our ship going. And we're doing a really good job of it. But we need your help, too. Any more? And you know what? I don't like doing this stuff. Anyway.
So. Any further questions for Ms. Peterson? And I don't want your jobs at all. Were there questions for Ms. Perlick? Good, she won't run against me next time. Or Ms. Wagner. If not, then I would ask Mr. Fent and Ms. Klinger if they would come up. I believe Mr. Kramer is gone. Are there questions for these folks? You know, I have a question for somebody here. If this system that we're talking about doing, if this is going to be such a good, if, you know, if what we're doing now works so well, and I think we had somebody from the service cooperative say that, if this works so well, why do we have a lot of people from some of the districts who are asking for this program? Why is this program being pushed so hard when at least, I mean, my emails are running 6-7 to 1 against doing this. I'm trying to understand who is it that wants it so badly and why is that, and, you know, what is causing that particular groundswell that want it so badly? And you two probably can't answer that question.
So, Madam Chair, to add to your question, why would districts and even some of the people represented by the gentleman that was here from the union, have they rejected being a part of a co-op that on a voluntary basis that's there now? Some of the opportunities that are now. I don't know that I quite understand why these options that are out there for savings have not been been used or rejected.
Well, maybe Mr. Fahey ought to be the one who tries to answer this question. You two can stay there, and we'll bring Mr. Fahey up again. And if you could just tell us why we, and then you also mentioned part-time employees. I don't think that we talked really about part-time employees before. So what you're doing is your union mostly looking for health insurance for part-time employees?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, to take the license that Mr. Fent used before when he brought Mr. Kramer up with him, I bring Mr. Johansson up with me for some technical advice. And let me just say to everyone here, not one of my 5,700 represented members thinks that health insurance is free or thinks any part of health insurance is free. My people, my members pay through their nose through property taxes, they pay through income taxes, and they pay out of their wages an extreme amount. In fact, one of my members gets from Howard Lake Waverly gets a check for $4.10 every pay period because the rest is deductions and health insurance premiums, literally working for the premiums. My members were for this before they hired me as their executive director. My membership was part of the initial overall labor management coalition that looked at that actually came up with the idea to produce the Redden and Anders study. My representatives, my staff representatives that work for me, negotiate, they bargain day in and day out on behalf of our members with school districts, and year after year after year, we've got more and more of our members that are on Minnesota Care because they can't afford the health premiums that negotiated between our union and the school districts. Health insurance costs are going up far more than wages, and they're eating up most of the school district's budget. And for the technical part, I hope you'll indulge me and allow Mr. Johansson to who's been more experienced in this than I.
Mr. Fahey, would you answer my other question first?
And that was?
Part-time employees. You cover a lot of part-time employees.
Yes.
Is it mostly bus drivers or school lunch workers or something?
In fact, a majority of my union are part-time employees. I would say even our paraeducators A good percentage of those are less than eight-hour employees. Most of our bus drivers, not all, but most of our bus drivers are part-time employees. Most of our custodians are full-time employees. Most of our food service workers are part-time employees. And so and most of the secretaries are full-time employees. But what is full-time? Some secretaries are 12-month employees, some are 9-month employees. Most of our paraeducators are, even the ones that work 8 hours a day, are 9-month employees. But a good percentage of my membership are part-time employees.
And you have 5,700 members, you said?
We represent 5,700 people in, I believe, 58 right now, school districts, 79 or 80 contracts.
And Mr. Fay, I'm just curious, bus drivers, school lunch workers, et cetera, in all those other districts that aren't part of your 58, who represents them?
They are represented either by no one, independent associations, AFSCME, SEIU, and the Teamsters have some.
Okay.
Oh, excuse me, and Education Minnesota actually represents some non-teaching employees, too. I apologize to my colleague.
And this plan would put all school employees represented by you or anyone else, all would go into this plan. Is that correct?
We would, if this pool was created and the plans produced by the board to all school districts, we would do exactly what we do now, sit down and negotiate on behalf of our members with the school districts. It is the feeling of the leadership of my union prior to me coming on board and since coming on board and the membership out there that more of our members would be able to have more affordable health insurance because of the trend line reduction in cost increases through a statewide pool for all school employees than if we continue the status quo.
I'm trying to understand, would they be treated like full-time employees so that you would put all the part-time employees into the pool and then
Madam Chair, members of the committee, insurance eligibility is bargained locally, and it's different in each district. To continue the plea from Ms. Peterson, we will keep things local. What's local now will be local, except the experience ratings will no longer be local. They will be at least regionalized and possibly statewide.
And there won't be choices anymore. There won't be local choice. They can't shop any place else if they don't like what's offered under this plan, correct?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for many of our rural districts, the choice is there is not a lot of choice out there in the first place.
Senator.
Madam Chair, you asked where is some of the impetus coming from, and at least judging by my emails and listening to Mr. Hoffman's analysis last week, there is my perception is that there's a regional effect. Smaller districts tend to be rural districts with smaller employees. Rural districts, there are fewer choices among providers, so in a lot of cases the provider costs can be higher, and then because they are smaller districts, the effects of experience rating can work against those smaller employers. So there, I see the advantage to those folks of being in bigger pools. I think one of the key issues that arises from that is that if all we're doing is moving money around within the system, there are good questions about doing this. The key argument is that you can save money in the system overall, not just help those smaller or more rural districts who have a tougher time with experience rating or where there's a monopoly with respect to health care, they can't get competition in pricing from physicians or from hospitals and therefore have higher costs.
Madam Chair, Senator Kelly, I think you took the words right out of my mouth there, sir. There's a reason. There's a reason. You know, I guess you're where you are. And to extrapolate upon that, our smaller districts, Browns Valley, Sleepy Eye, are in favor of this, and our larger districts, Rochester, Anoka, St. Paul, my membership in those larger districts and smaller districts are in favor of this. Not one of our local units has opposed this proposal.
Madam Chair, you asked about...
Mr. Johansson.
Yes, my name is Lee Johansson with Education Minnesota. You asked about the support and where the support came from. Education Minnesota represents 70,000 school employees throughout the state, in every district in the state. A group that large is not likely to have unanimity. And as you saw today, there are some of our locals who are not supportive of this initiative. But do not be misled. In a scientific survey of our 70,000 members, 80% of our members understand and support our proposal. We have approximately 20 locals that have opposed our proposal. But again, don't be misled. Our local support from the very small locals in Cyrus with 8 members to our largest locals in Apple Valley, Rosemont, Eagan, in Anoka, the largest self-insured pool in the state, which incidentally received a 20% rate increase in 1 year and went from one of those mythical low-cost districts to being a high-cost district in 1 year. Savings weren't there. Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester teachers and support staff support the system. Don't be misled into thinking that because a few vocal people came up and told you of their perceived flaws in the system, that represents the public school employees of the state of Minnesota. It does not. And then further, the myth that somehow or another the current system is working, I would remind you all that in the year 1999-2000, school employees and their employer partners were spending $400 million a year on health insurance. In the year 2004-2005, school employees and their employer partners were spending $770 million for insurance, and many of the plans have been diminished. They're purchasing a lesser product. I would find it hard to explain to anybody how they believe that system is working and how we can believe that that system is serving the needs of the school districts and spending that money wisely, as our school board member from Wayzata so aptly put, or whether or not there could be a better way to do it. We had insurance increases last year that ranged from, on average, around 7.5%. Those same districts this year are getting 30% proposals. Don't be misled to believe that a temporary restraint on insurance premiums means that the trend has changed. This system is badly broken, and we need to have it fixed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johansson. You did get the last word. However, what you are promising, if I understand it correctly, is a better program, a cheaper program, and one that won't have the fluctuations, and one, however, that is going to take everybody and try to bring them to the middle so that the districts who are paying more will pay less, and the districts who have put in all kinds of programs to save are going to pay more. That's what it looks like. Now, what I wonder is your promise of savings, can that be fulfilled? That is my concern. However, we've got session in 4 minutes. So I think we're going, and I can't tell you, Senator Stumpf did not make it down today. I assume there will be a Thursday meeting if we stay on this same tiresome schedule and get nothing done.
Well, Madam Chair, if leadership provides targets, I'm sure Senator Stumpf would be well inclined to have a meeting sooner than Thursday. But as of right now, my understanding is that likely Thursday, barring some wonderful breakthrough among them.
It's very sad that we cannot get to targets here because this is not good business for schools. But that being said, thank you all for being here this morning. And we are adjourned.